I'm Brandi Cruz. Coming up today on Undivided, as was his plan all along, King County Executive Dow Constantine finally gets to use his appointed sheriff as a political pawn. Plus, Washington just became an even worse place for gun shop owners. Also, Bob Ferguson has ignited his attacks against his likely 2024 opponent for governor, and they are nothing if not predictable. That and more coming up today on Undivided. Remember, you can support our show for just $5 a month by signing up at undividedpod.com. Hello and welcome to Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you so much for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. I'm Brandi Cruz. A happy Monday to each and every one of you. Quick reminder, we are not going to have a show tomorrow. We will be at the memorial for fallen Washington State Patrol Trooper Christopher Gadd. We encourage you to attend if you are able to attend, but we will not have our regular live show tomorrow as we will be there. There is a showdown looming between the city of Burien and King County. And look, this is not a surprise, and I blame King County voters for part of this, because you'll recall that King County voters voted away their right to vote for the sheriff. So, which is just crazy to me, how they were able to be convinced to do that. And I put most of that up to Seattle. I think this was in the midst of, 2020 and defund the police and, oh, we hate the police and they're terrible. So we don't want, citizens to elect the sheriff. Let's let a politician appoint the sheriff. Which is just about to think that the position of a sheriff would be somehow less political if you or they'd be more accountable to people if you let a politician appoint the sheriff was a crazy thought to me. But now it's done. And now this is what King County has to deal with. They have to deal with having a sheriff that is a political appointee. And that is a political appointee of someone like Dow Constantine, the King County executive, who is highly ideological. And now we are finally starting to see the consequences of that. So the city of Burien is dealing, like a lot of cities are, with a severe homelessness issue. And they've been sort of ground zero for this with, former Burien city council members trying to encourage homelessness and homeless camping on certain public areas. And there's like literally there was an effort from former city council members to like have more homeless like tents near City Hall. So it's been this big back and forth. Well, the city of Burien, like a lot of other places, said, look, we are going to say you cannot have camping in public places if there is shelter available to you. Simple. You can't put your tent here because we have a shelter available to you. And if you don't want to take the shelter that we have for you, then you've got to move somewhere else. Well, now, who would enforce that? The King County Sheriff's Office, which contracts its services to the city of Burien. But now that we have a King County Sheriff that is a political appointee under Dow Constantine, you have the sheriff's office saying, we're not going to enforce this ordinance in the city of Burien. So here's the article that first came out from our friend Jason Rance. The headline, King County Sheriff directs deputies to ignore Burien encampment ban. The appointed King County Sheriff instructed her deputies to ignore an updated Burien ordinance that prohibits a homeless encampment within 500 feet of locations with vulnerable populations, such as schools and parks. She did not inform city officials, leading the mayor to accuse her department of acting politically. Citing concerns over the constitutionality of the ordinance, King County Sheriff Patty Cole Tindall directed deputies Friday morning not to enforce it. Cole Tindall did not inform Burien City officials, including Mayor Kevin Schilling, of the decision. Council members were reportedly caught off guard, some first learning about the memo when the Jason Ranch Show on KTTH reached out for comment. And this was confirmed by Sam Campbell, who's a reporter at Cairo Radio. He goes out to the city of Burien, and he's out, trying to talk to people who are living in tents, who are homeless, when a King County Sheriff's deputy is called to the area. And Sam Campbell asks him, just to be clear, are you going to enforce the ban on camping? Here's what he said.
Just to be clear, make sure I heard correctly, that the part that won't be enforced right now is which part?
The actual camping center.
Oh,
The trespass can be enforced if it's up against the building.
Okay, so they just got to be away from the building?
Yeah.
And so it was sort of validation of what Jason Rantz had reported. And also, you just have to go down to the city of Berrien, as our friend Jonathan Cho did, to see that it's not being enforced. There are tents absolutely everywhere. And it's not just about people just living in tents, right? It's about everything that comes along with allowing these encampments to fester. It's about the impact it has on businesses. I mean, who wants to visit one of those businesses when there's a whole long line of tents in front of it? And then it's also about the criminal element that, yes, comes along with the transient population. Drugs. Drugs everywhere. There's been an uptick in crime in areas where encampments are. Uptick in drug use equals uptick in crime because you have to commit crime sometimes in order to fund your drug habits, so stealing from businesses. And then when you're on drugs, you're more likely to be violent and dangerous and unhinged. So here you have a situation where the city of Berrien has passed a common sense ordinance that is in line with federal court rulings like the one out of Boise, Idaho that said, you know, that one was specifically about you can't just ban people from camping somewhere unless you have shelter to give them. So the idea with what you see a lot of cities doing is, okay, we're banning camping as long as we have shelter for you. So that seems constitutional to me and in line with federal court rulings. If you have a shelter for someone, you offer it to that person and they won't take it. No, you don't get to camp on the sidewalk in our downtown corridor where you can shoot up drugs. You don't get to do it. So now you have a situation where the city of Berrien is the entity that is dealing with the consequences of the King County Sheriff's Office, which is contracted with that city to provide law enforcement services. They get to deal with the consequences of an appointed sheriff not wanting to follow or enforce or have her deputies enforce the ordinance. And in case there's any question in the world about where that directive is coming from, that it's not coming from the sheriff. It's coming from her boss, the King County executive. Again, it's coming from a politician who now controls the office of the sheriff because voters decided that was a good idea. Our friend Jonathan Cho got his hands on an internal email from the mayor of Berrien, Kevin Schilling, who, you know, there were some emails going back and forth about all of this and trying to get to the bottom of it. And the mayor noticed that a response about this was coming from the comms director for the county executive. He wrote, "Why is the comms director for Dow Constantine responding to press requests on the topic of the sheriff?" Well, that is because the executive's office now controls the sheriff. The sheriff isn't an independently elected official anymore. The sheriff doesn't answer to the voters. The sheriff answers to a politician. And the voters allowed that to happen. So yes, when the sheriff makes a decision not to enforce something like the camping ban, that decision is coming from above. So it would make sense that it's the PR flackey for the executive's office who's responding to a city's questions directed at their sheriff's department about, hey, we have this ordinance, why aren't you helping us enforce it? The city also did issue a more lengthy response saying that they do believe that this is a violation of the agreement they have with the King County Sheriff's Office to provide them services. It says, the King County Sheriff's Office has advised its deputies against enforcing Berrien's public camping ordinance, which is a breach of the interlocal agreement for contracted law enforcement services provided by King County to Berrien. According to the contract for services, if there is a disagreement regarding a contracting city's, quote, procedure, policy, goal, or operation, the solution is not unilateral action by King County, its sheriff, or members of the sheriff's office. Rather, the parties shall negotiate to reach a final determination. And that makes sense, right? That you wouldn't have, if you've got an agreement as the sheriff's office to serve a city, that you wouldn't just say, oh, we're not going to enforce this law and this law and this law and this law, and we're not going to tell the city about it. Because that, to me, is the worst part, right? If you have the sheriff that genuinely has concerns about the constitutionality of Berrien's law not to allow homeless camps to proliferate, then what would be a common sense way to deal with that? What would be a way you and I would deal with a disagreement? The sheriff would go to the mayor and to the city council and say, hey, we've got a concern about whether this is constitutional. I don't want my deputies to be in a place to have to enforce something that's unconstitutional and open all of us up to lawsuits. So let's talk through what we should do. Is there a way you can tweak it? Is there something we can do moving forward? No. Instead of doing that, you go behind their back, stop enforcing it because your buddy or your boss, the King County executive, told you not to do it. And then the city is left wondering what the heck is going on. Why are all these tents here? You're supposed to be enforcing this. This is government at its worst. And this is what happens when you don't have a sheriff that's accountable to the people. If the sheriff was accountable to the people, I guarantee you the sheriff would have gone to the city and said, hey, I'm concerned about this. What can we do? How can we make sure that the city doesn't have tents proliferating everywhere with drug use and crime, while also making sure that we're not enforcing something that's unconstitutional? But I would also, you know, argue and push back against the whole, oh, this might not be constitutional thing. Again, when it comes to the federal decisions that are on the books, it basically says you can't prohibit camping unless there's, you know, shelter available elsewhere. Well, who do you think is responsible for making sure that there's enough shelter for the homeless in King County? King County. King County Executive Dow Constantine. So if there isn't shelter available, even though we spend billions and billions and billions and billions and billions of dollars, if there isn't shelter available for the homeless in Berrien, whose fault is that? Dow Constantine. He's been the executive now for almost 16 years. So if the reason why Berrien can't enforce its no camping ordinance is there isn't shelter for some reason for those people who are setting up tents in their business core. That is Dow Constantine's fault. So you have Dow Constantine and people with his ideology who create a homeless crisis that is so bad, that is so severe, through their lack of enforcement, through hands off on drugs, all of these things. And then they convince people to give them billions of dollars. Hey, we got to fix this crisis that we created. We need billions of dollars. We'll buy homeless hotels. We'll do all of this. We'll give money to our cronies. Oh, well, then it turns out that that's not even working. The homeless crisis is still just as bad as it was. And you've got some of these homeless hotels that just sit vacant. Oh, well, gosh, now we've created a homeless crisis that's terrible. We asked you for billions and billions of dollars. We absolutely squandered it because the homeless crisis isn't getting any worse. And now cities like Berrien just have to deal with the consequences, and we're not even going to allow our sheriff's office to help them keep homeless tents off the sidewalks. And these are the people who we keep putting back in office. It's truly mind-boggling to me. So the city of Berrien does not look like it's backing down from this showdown, and I truly hope they don't. I hope they find a way, I don't know how, to enforce this ordinance, to push back. I mean, hell, if they want to sue the county, I don't know what it is. But they have made it clear that they believe this is the best policy for their citizens, to protect their community, to keep their community safe and thriving. And now they're at the mercy, so to speak, of a political appointee and a sheriff, because voters chose that route. And they've got to figure out, how do we stick to our guns when everyone above us is working against us? So the city of Berrien, we have your back as much as we can. But I think it is a good example for them to set, to be pushing back against this Seattle ideology that is making their community less safe and that is keeping them from carrying out common sense policies. Mm-hmm. Washington State just became a much worse place to have a gun shop, as if anybody wants to have a gun shop here anymore anyway. But I've been saying that the goal here of politicians in Olympia is to say, okay, well, the Second Amendment is there, can't get rid of that easily. So let's just make it so difficult to sell guns. Let's make it as unprofitable as possible, as difficult as possible. Let's open them up to possible civil liability and lawsuits, and just try to get all of these gun shops to go out of business. You know, let's tax them. What was the ammunition tax? You know, let's do whatever we can to make it difficult for them. Let's target them as a business, and then they'll just go away. And it's like, then we can just get rid of gun ownership without actually having to violate the Second Amendment. So there was something that happened a few days ago. You guys might recall that there was a law passed in Olympia that, and this wasn't this session, this was a previous session, that basically said that if you're a gun manufacturer and like someone uses your gun to commit a mass shooting, you might be able to hold a gun manufacturer accountable for that, which we talked about at the time, which is just an absolutely wild thought that someone who, you know, is selling a gun legally might be held accountable for someone using that gun illegally. So a judge, a federal judge, has rejected legal challenges to that law because as soon as it passed, folks in the gun industry were like, you can't do that. And so they filed a challenge, and now a judge has sided with the state of Washington. This is the headline from the Associated Press. U.S. judge rejects challenge to Washington state law that could hold gun makers liable for shootings. And just a reminder of what that law did, according to the AP, it requires the industry to exercise reasonable controls in making, selling, and marketing weapons, including steps to keep guns from being sold to people known to be dangerous or to straw buyers. It allows the attorney general or private parties, such as the family members of shooting victims, to sue for violations or damages under the state's Consumer Protection Act. Great, like we need it to be any easier for Bob Ferguson to sue people who he doesn't agree with politically. And of course, Bob celebrated this on Twitter. He said, my office continues to be undefeated against the gun lobby. Yesterday, we protected a law that ensures gun manufacturers and sellers can be held liable for negligence. These companies need to do their part to protect our communities. You know, and one of the things I would say about that, is there any more regulated industry that sells things than the gun industry? You know, when you talk about the background checks and the files that you have to keep, the records that you have to keep, if you go through everything you're supposed to do under law and someone uses that gun to commit a crime, haven't you taken all the reasonable steps necessary? And if you don't do all those steps, aren't you already breaking the law? If you don't put someone through appropriate background checks, for instance, aren't you already breaking the law? So why do you even need a law like this? It seems to me that the only purpose of that law, and which is now upheld on this ruling, is for Bob Ferguson to find sneaky ways to just sue people who make and sell guns, just like he finds sneaky ways to try to sue police officers for doing things that were within policy and training. And it's just another, you know, way for him to say, oh, look, we're holding the gun manufacturers accountable. So you combine that, and now this federal judge is ruling upholding that law just a couple days ago, with one of the newest laws that will soon be on the books in Washington state. We talked about this as it was under consideration. It's now heading to the governor's desk, and of course he's going to sign it. And it is House Bill 2118. Remember, this is the bill that puts insane, onerous restrictions and requirements on gun shops. So much so that the cost is enough to put these gun shops out of business. It has this long list. And when I say long list, it was like two full pages in the bill. Like two full pages of added requirements if you operate a legal firearm shop in the state of Washington. We're talking about things like specifications on the type of cameras and surveillance equipment you have to have, what doors and windows and points in the store those cameras have to be pointed at, how often those cameras have to be recording, live monitoring of those feeds, retention of video and audio recordings for a specified period of time, certain bars on windows, certain doors that have to go up that would be harder to breach if someone wants to ram a stolen vehicle into them. And they're basically saying, oh, this is so that somebody doesn't come in and steal a gun. Meanwhile, Democrats have created an environment where it's really easy for someone to steal a vehicle, not get in trouble for it, ram it into a store and drive away and not be pursued by law enforcement. But I digress. So again, you're creating this environment that is contributing to a problem that you're now saying you're trying to solve without solving the root cause of the problem. I mean, we're talking about things with these this HB 2118, when it talks about the amount of insurance that these firearm dealers have to have, where the guns have to be stored overnight, and then how you have to make sure the guns are stored and locked up while you're in business hours so someone doesn't, I guess, take a gun and run out with it or steal it or shoot someone or shoot themselves in the store. Long list of things that is specific, again, to the firearm industry, that we're going to be talking about probably hundreds of thousands of dollars in added security costs, in the costs associated with getting the hardware needed to store all of the cloud software that needed to store all of this video and audio data, the costs associated with added insurance. Tell me what the goal of that is. Again, we're talking about one of already the most regulated industries that exists. And the law also acts as if you have these firearm dealers who don't understand already that they're going to be a target for thieves. You really think that these firearm dealers who have all of this inventory that is their livelihood are just going to rely on, oh, a little key lock. Oh, we just got a regular old door, no big deal. No, they already have an abundance of security measures in place, be it video surveillance or whatever it is, to protect their livelihood and to protect their inventory and, yes, to protect the community. So all that this is, again, is an effort to put them out of business. And it will put them out of business. I am very curious, a year from now, the number of federal firearm licensees and dealers in the state of Washington a year from now compared to what it is right now, and even compared to what it was 5 years ago. So this, to me, is a violation of the Second Amendment in that it makes it so difficult to run a firearms business and more difficult, thus, for you and I to legally obtain a firearm. And so they want to find all these end routes around the Constitution. And they're able, obviously, legally, to get away with it. And I think it should be concerning for anyone who values the Constitution. I've said this a million times about the Second Amendment. Like, look, if you want to go through the process of changing it, fine. There's a reason why our founding fathers put forth a process to amend the Constitution or to get rid of amendments or to add amendments to the Constitution. If you really feel like the Second Amendment, as Americans, if the majority of Americans feel like the Second Amendment is out of step with where we are as a country, fine, like go about the difficult process of changing it. Who am I to say that the will of the people wouldn't be valid? But until then, allowing the government to slowly chip away at our constitutional rights or one amendment that you might not agree with, like the Second Amendment, that just gives them the power and the motivation to start chipping away at other protections that we have in the Constitution. And as someone who makes a living off the First Amendment, that is a very slippery slope and a very dangerous thing. And anyone who celebrates it is simply dead wrong. All right, coming up next, the state of Washington is spending an ungodly amount of money trying to protect the salmon. And as with most things that the state of Washington and government does, it's not working. But they're spending an insane amount of money anyway. And this is going to be very relevant to the effort to repeal the Climate Commitment Act. So I want to talk about all of that coming up next. First, we've been talking about our friend Wes Jones with sellwithwes.com, sellwithwes.com. We've been saying on the show that, you know, we're waiting for the Fed to drop interest rates, obviously, which I think they'll do at some point in 2024. And when that happens, if you've been thinking about selling your home, you need to be ready to put your home on the market day one to take advantage of that huge influx that there are going to be, the pent-up demand that's out there. And so if you go to sellwithwes.com, there's a couple things that he's going to do. He's going to give you a free market analysis so you know kind of what your expectations are depending on where your home is, all of that. He's also going to talk about some of the services they offer that you're simply not going to find anywhere else, like their Listing Boost concierge service. If you need to make some cosmetic upgrades to your home, for instance, one of the wonderful things about that is they can handle those projects. They can manage those projects. They can even help you pay for those projects up front. It's like totally stress-free. But the very first thing when you go to sellwithwes.com is start by using their home value calculator to see how much your home is worth. It might be worth more than you think. Sellwithwes.com, a better way to sell your home. All right, the following segment is brought to you in partnership with our friends over at Future 42. Turn your frustration into action at future42.org. $1 million a day. $1 million a day. That is how much the state of Washington is spending on just one effort to try to save and restore Washington State's salmon population. Now look, I love the salmon. I love salmon fishing. I love the environment. I think we all do. I think we all understand the need to protect and make sure that this wonderful resource is available for generations to come. But one of the challenges about this particular project is not only is it insanely expensive, I mean, costs that are almost difficult to wrap your mind around, but simultaneously, it's not working. And that's not coming from me. That's coming from the Seattle Times. So the Seattle Times did this entire investigative report. I encourage you to read it. It came out over the weekend about what they call the costliest salmon recovery program in Washington. And they give a little background here because some of this is mandated by a court for the state of Washington to do. It says in 2013, a federal judge sided with 21 Western Washington tribes who argued the salmon blocking culverts violated their treaty fishing rights. The judge issued an injunction ordering the State Department of Transportation to replace its salmon barriers blocking habitat by 2030. Culverts have been used for decades, and if designed properly, they allow fish to pass through without problems. But others are too steep, too narrow, or have other flaws. Nearly 80 years ago, the state attorney general found that fish-blocking culverts violated state law. The Seattle Times analyzed the state's own project reports and found that for every barrier the state removes on a waterway, 9 others upstream and 2 downstream partially or fully blocked fish migration. Most of those other barriers are not scheduled to be removed. The latest estimate for all this construction has basically doubled from $3.8 billion to as much as $7.8 billion, roughly the cost of replacing the Highway 99 viaduct along Seattle's waterfront twice over, plus change, or you could buy 2 new electric ferry fleets. So to put that in layman's terms, you've got this court order that says, hey, the way that some of these culverts are designed by the state and Washington State Department of Transportation is not allowing for fish migration. So you've got to go in by 2030 and you have to remove them, change them, update them, upgrade them. The problem is that WashDOT has to do that to certain culverts, but you might have upstream other obstacles that the state is not going to and is not required to remove, so the state's not concerning themselves with those obstacles. So they could spend $100 million removing this set of obstacles for the salmon. And they know that just a short way upstream, those salmon are going to hit another obstacle that they're not going to be able to get over. So you're dumping hundreds of millions of dollars, billions of dollars, into fixing culverts when you know it won't actually fix the problem. More on the Seattle Times investigation. Again, removing WA salmon barriers surges to $1 million a day, but even the Times admits results are murky. It says WashDOT and Governor Inslee's administration aren't factoring in, because the court order doesn't require it, the countless other culverts owned by municipalities, railroads, homeowners, and others that block salmon migration. In some cases, the work has restored good salmon habitat, but in many others, WashDOT and the Inslee administration have narrowly focused on fulfilling the terms of the court order and haven't seized opportunities to prevent their investments from being ineffective or even worthless. Now the state needs $3.5 billion to $4 billion more than the legislature previously allocated, more than half of WashDOT's annual budget. But the doubling costs would buy a relatively small amount of habitat and require construction on Interstate 5, I-90, and other major highways. So not only are they spending money on projects that cost twice what it cost us to remove the Alaskan Way Viaduct and replace it with a deep bore tunnel, not only, as the Seattle Times said, could you buy 2 full new electric ferry fleets, but they need even more money, $3.5 billion to $4 billion more, half of WashDOT's full annual budget, to keep doing this work, work that even the Seattle Times acknowledges might be fruitless, because once you fix this, you're not fixing, and the state doesn't seem concerned with fixing, whatever else upstream might continue to impact the salmon. Now, one of the reasons why I believe the Seattle Times is doing this now, and I want you to be laser focused on it, is because the Climate Commitment Act could be repealed in November. Let me explain. One of the things that the money from the Climate Commitment Act is going to help fund is this court order and carrying out this court order, which, as we now know, is incredibly expensive, about $1 million a day. So what I believe this Seattle Times article is laying the groundwork for if all the other arguments about repealing the CCA aren't landing, I mean, we've seen Mark Elias lying about all sorts of crazy stuff about, oh, if you take away our CCA money, we won't be able to fix the roads, we won't be able to fix the bridges, all of these things. Well, if those lies are just so crazy that people aren't going to believe them, what they're now going to turn to and hope to appeal to progressive voters on are the salmon. They're going to say, hey, we've got this court order and we've got to carry it out to save the salmon. And the CCA money is helping us do that. And if you repeal the CCA, then not only are we going to lose money that's helping us follow through with the court order, but the salmon are going to die and future generations won't have them. What they won't tell you is what they're already doing is, according to the Times, probably fruitless. So they know that they're dumping billions of dollars into an effort that is not making much of a difference. But they want that money to continue to come in anyway. So rather than, I don't know, say, hey, we have this court order that we have to live up to, so we're replacing these culverts, but at the same time, if we replace these culverts but we don't fix all the issues further upstream, then this is going to be fruitless, so we better do that too, if the goal is really saving the salmon. But given the Seattle Times report, and I would argue that the goal is not saving the salmon. It's either simply checking off boxes to make sure they're in compliance with a court order, or it's continuing to be able to have leverage to get billions of dollars from taxpayers who also want to save the salmon. Or it's a combination of the two. Let's use the court order as leverage to continue to get billions of dollars from taxpayers that we can shovel out to our political cronies and our allies. And at the end of the day, I mean, 20 years from now, they'll realize that it didn't save the salmon anyway, but by then we'll be cushy in retirement. $1 million a day for a project to save the salmon that's not actually saving the salmon. The state of Washington's government in a nutshell. All right, coming up next in our segment, Unbelievable, Bob Ferguson's freeze on campaigning, on fundraising is finally over with the end of the legislative session. And I'll tell you, his attacks on Dave Reichert are nothing if not predictable. First, I've been encouraging you guys to take the First Mark challenge. First Mark has been wonderful for Mike and I. We've been members of the First Mark family for about a year. They now handle all of our insurance and we never pay them a dime. We took the First Mark challenge about a year ago. We went to them, we scheduled a little Zoom call, you know, showed them all of our current insurance, talked about our insurance needs. We knew we were woefully underinsured, which freaked us out because we're like, gosh, we need better insurance, but we don't want to pay more money. And guess what? They went out and shopped the market. And they found us better insurance for the same price. We never would have been able to do that on our own. So we have been diehard members of the First Mark family ever since. So I encourage all of you, if you haven't made time already, to set aside an hour or so to take the First Mark challenge. FirstMarkInsurance.com, FirstMarkInsurance.com. The very best part is, well, there's a couple. One, local company that's been in this business for a long time, and they're going to pick up the phone when you call. You got a claim? They're going to pick up the phone. I got a new car like a month ago. Called to update my insurance. It was like two rings and a human being woman picked up the phone and we had a nice chat. And the very, very best part is First Mark Insurance works for you, not the insurance company. So they're always going to have your best interests in mind and you never pay them a dime. It's great. All right. Bob Ferguson is back to fundraising off fear mongering. Let's talk about it in our segment, Unbelievable. You probably recall this. If you're an elected official in Washington, you're prohibited from fundraising during the legislative session. There's a fundraising freeze, which I think is appropriate, right? Well, as soon as that freeze lifted, Bob Ferguson was all over it on Twitter. And it's so predictable, it's funny. And that's all I could say as I looked at that. And I was like, this sad sack man. he's so scared. Because, you know, he never imagined that Dave Reichert would run. And I think a lot of people didn't because Dave Reichert has been this sort of like, oh, he might run and then he never does. And now he did. And Bob's like, shoot, you know, and he thinks he's owed the governor's office. And so now he's got a real challenge and he's terrified. But then it's like he can't stand on his own record. And Dave Reichert, I'm sorry, there's really not a lot to attack the man on. You know, he doesn't have any baggage. He is a very reasonable, I don't know if he's moderate because he is still pretty conservative, but he's a very reasonable, nice, kind human being. So Bob's like, what do I got? What do you guys think he has? What do you think? Any guesses? I don't know. Trump? Gah. Yep. He tweets out, day 255 of Dave Reichert's campaign for governor and of Dave Reichert hiding whether he supports Donald Trump for president. It's like, this guy. And he sent out multiple, again, freeze ends, and that's all it was, like, Reichert, Trump, abortion, Reichert, Trump, abortion. He sent out three tweets. Again, there was the day, this is day 255 of Reichert supporting whether he supports Donald Trump. If you're afraid to say who you support for president, how can you make tough decisions as governor? To which I'm thinking, wait, does that mean you support Biden? Because that might be worse, you know? Then he goes on, we have just three, this is a poll. Oh, he did a poll on Twitter. We have just 3 days until Tuesday's presidential primary, which is tomorrow. Will Congressman Dave Reichert have the political courage to tell Washingtonians that he is voting for Donald Trump? Check yes or no. This is all this guy got. And then he says, anti-choice Republican Dave Reichert remains silent on whether he will vote for Donald Trump. He lacks the political courage to stand up to Donald Trump and lead this state. This is literally all the man has. And I've interviewed, when I was at Fox 13, I've interviewed Dave Reichert about Donald Trump. I mean, he left Congress in part because he was disappointed with, I believe, the political environment that had been created post Donald Trump's election in 2016. He's made it clear he's no Trump stan, just like I'm no Trump stan. But I would much rather have a governor who maybe, possibly, might vote for Donald Trump and be able to work with Donald Trump if he's the president, than a governor who uses the power of his office to go after his political enemies. A governor who, as attorney general, could not stop bragging about how many times he sued Donald Trump and was so laser focused on hating Donald Trump that he completely abandoned his responsibilities to the people of the state of Washington. I'd much rather have a governor who, oh, maybe might vote for Donald Trump than a governor who hides documents from the public, than a governor who is not transparent at all and has proven that as attorney general. So if we're weighing pros and cons here, I'd take a governor who's going to vote for Donald Trump over an attorney general who has done all the things that Bob Ferguson has done, like politically prosecute police officers. No thanks. And also, as I've pointed out, I've never voted for Donald Trump, and 2024 might be the first time I do. So yeah, I think it is possible, and we're in a climate right now where things are so bad that even moderates and independents who have been anti-Trump are considering voting for the guy. I don't know if Dave Reichert's going to vote for the guy or not. I do understand the strategy that Dave Reichert is employing in not being firm about it, because right now he's in a Republican primary process with him and Sammy Byrd. And so if the answer is, and he's also got a, he's running in a state where it's hard to win as a Republican. So you really think that a smart candidate's going to come out who wants to win, who knows what it takes to win, is going to be like, make America great again and wear a red hat on the campaign trail? No, that would just be stupid. And that would be campaign suicide. So yeah, at some point he's going to have to tell people whether he's voting for Donald Trump or not. It's a question that's going to continue to come up. But from a strategy perspective, I understand why he's not too eager to talk about it. But anyway, Bob Ferguson, you got nothing to stand on, nothing else, no other policy issues that actually impact people's everyday lives. You just have to continue to talk about Donald Trump. That is one of the many, 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 many reasons why I would never vote for you. Many, many, many. Many reasons. All right, a little bit of national news. If you guys watch the State of the Union, they had him on a drug. There's no way.
Oh my gosh.
There's no way that they didn't have Biden on some sort of
upper. That's why he was late.
Because, well, no, I think he was late because Hamas protesters, like, blocked the route, didn't they? So I'll give him that. But there's no way, because how he was during the State of the Union is completely different from how he is all other times.
Right.
You know, he was clearly very awake and astute and all of that. So they had the guy on something. Now, I didn't even need to look at Twitter to know what the responses would be. Democrats would be like, oh, this proves he is strong and he's a fighter. And Republicans are going to be like, well, that was unhinged and he just screamed at us and it was very divisive. And I think both those things can be true simultaneously. Man, I did think that President Biden came across as much more coherent than usual. But the fight in him was incredibly divisive.
Angry.
And also angry. And, at, you know, 10 minutes in, I was like, stop yelling at
me.
You know?
Exactly.
But it was like he overcompensated. It was definitely an overcompensation for trying to get people to believe that he's not too old and too, you know, not fit to be president. But also the content of the speech was horrible in the sense that you're talking about the State of the Union when you're supposed to address Americans and address Congress and talk about what's happening in our country, the good and the bad. He starts by talking about Ukraine. So it's like, okay, this is supposed to be the State of the Union. And then he gets into January 6th, 3 years ago. At what point does that stop being one of the key things that Democrats talk about? Like at the beginning, in the first few minutes of your State of the Union, you're talking about January 6th, 3 years ago. And then he gets into Trump, and then he gets into abortion, and then he goes back to Trump. The whole thing was crazy. And then there was, you know, an insane amount of heckling, which I am never a fan of. Remember when it used to be, I think it was under Obama, right? Mm-hmm. Somebody called Obama a liar, and that was like, the decorum, like, why would you do that? And that was all over the news. And now it's like, well, gosh, people are screaming all the time State of the Union.
Obnoxious.
Whether it was Democrats screaming at Trump or Nancy Pelosi like a petulant child ripping the script in half, we have lost all decorum in Congress and in American politics. It's a disaster. But one of one of the episodes of shouting during the State of the Union was Marjorie Taylor Greene. And she was shouting at President Biden about Lake and Riley, the young woman who was killed by an illegal immigrant in Georgia. And Biden, you know, grabs this pin that Marjorie Taylor Greene had handed him on the way in that said, Lake and Riley, say her name. And he holds it up and he's like, Lincoln Riley. So he gets her name wrong. But then, and this is the clip that we were going to play, Biden did an interview, you know, with MSNBC, Jonathan Caperhart, who's just like a sympathizer. And he brought up that during the speech, Biden had said, you know, Lincoln Riley killed by an illegal. And oh my gosh, you can't, as a Democrat or progressive, you can't call them illegals. You have to call them undocumented.
You use the word illegal when talking about the man who allegedly killed Lake and Riley.
An undocumented person. And I shouldn't have used illegal. It's undocumented. And look, when I spoke about the difference between Trump and me, one of the things I talked about on the border was that the way he talks about vermin, the way he talks about these people polluting the blood. I talked about what I'm not going to do, what I won't do. I'm not going to treat any of these people with disrespect. Look, they built the country. The reason our economy is growing, we have to control the border and more orderly flow. But I don't share his view at all.
So you regret using that word?
Yes.
Why are we concerned with the feelings of someone who killed a young woman? Why are we more concerned with what he called her killer than the fact that she's dead and that he killed her? This is just, and it goes back to this kind of woke ideology and identitarianism. And you won't see that again, you know, and now he's like has to, you know, apologize to CNBC, MSNBC, CNN for using the word illegal to describe a killer. It's just really wild stuff. Also on the immigration front, this is coming to a town near you because this happened over in, was it New Hampshire?
Denver.
No, previously. I think it happened in New Hampshire. And now in Denver, residents are being asked to house illegal immigrants or asylum seekers. And this whole influx, or as the city of Denver calls them, newcomers.
Newcomers.
This is from Denverite. As Denver closes new immigrant shelters, it's asking landlords to rent to people exiting them. On Tuesday, the city launched a program gathering information from landlords with property vacancies that rent for less than $2,000 per month. The city's goal is to connect property owners with new immigrants in need of permanent housing. The challenges of securing housing are combined with the fact that many new immigrants lack work authorization that would let them secure a legal employment. At points in the past few months, some new immigrants have camped on Denver streets. And then they go in and they say that they reached out to landlords. Hey, would you be willing to provide housing to some of these newcomers? Which, who is going to pay for that housing? The landlords aren't expected to let them use it for free, not yet at least. But just wait. Just wait, because that's where we're heading, where they're going to expect us. They're going to expect landlords, anyone with empty units. You're going to have to. The government's going to find a way to mandate that you let newcomers live there. it's going to be paid for with taxpayer funds. So you or I, a Denver resident who's hardworking, who's got a job and, you know, like $2,000 a month for rent is a lot, but they're making it work and they're paying their bills. They don't get the government. They don't get government handouts. And then you have someone who crosses the border illegally and they could get the apartment right next to you for free. In fact, your tax money is going to fund it. In what world is that right? In what world does that make any sense? And gosh, I think back to like the constitutional amendment that protects us from being forced to quarter troops. I feel like we might need a constitutional amendment that protects us from being forced to quarter migrants. Because that is absolutely the direction it's heading.
Well, they're trying to pressure Airbnb owners. Yeah, so if Airbnb, you have an Airbnb, and why wouldn't you? If it's vacant and the government's willing to give you money.
But I would also say there's no
protection.
No, I agree. Think of all the things as a tenant that you have to do before you're able to rent a space. You know, they have your social security number. They have your identification. Mm-hmm. They can run your criminal history in most places. They can run your criminal history. They can figure out your rental history. Do you have a history of, being evicted or anything like that? So you know whether the place that you've worked hard for that you're using as an investment is in good hands, whether you're ever going to be able to get them the freaking out of there. And now you got the government being like, oh, all that stuff you require hardworking, law-abiding people to do, just push that aside and like, well, let's just put this person in here. I mean, I get it. Yeah, you might be willing to, if you're a vacancy, like, would I rather have a vacancy or a risky tenant? I guess it just depends on where you're at financially.
Or what that, I mean, you can Airbnb anything. And in this case, you're not doing it through Airbnb. So you could just be like, oh, I got this shed back here. It's going to be my new Airbnb, government, right. Do you want to pay me for it?
Like, I don't know, but I'm sorry, but we need a constitutional amendment against the forced quartering of immigrants. If I also think back to, where was it? You remember, it was New Hampshire, wasn't it? Or was it Boston?
Were they forced people?
They asked people. And there was this white lady on the news in Boston who, and the reporter's like, she feels like she, it's like a Central American immigrant.
Yes,
she feels like she has her own personal chef because so-and-so loves to cook. And it's like this rich white lady. I was like, that's slavery. She's letting this chick live with her and talking about how old. Mm-hmm. Oh, she feel like
not paying her, own her
private chef. I was like, you guys, it's so funny. It's like an SNL skit. I'm shocked SNL really actually didn't do a skit on that. Oh, speaking of SNL skit, really quick before we get to questions and comments, mm-hmm. Did you see the Republican response to the State of the Union, Senator Katie Britt? It was terrible.
It was so bad.
And I feel bad. Public speaking is a skill. Like, it really is. And there are some people who just are not good at it. I really do believe, like, I quit a lot of sports to do speech in middle school because I wanted to be on the news. So It's absolutely a learned skill. And I think it's so valuable for kids to be able to speak publicly. But this poor Senator Katie Britt, who's like a junior senator, who there's this wonderful opportunity, and I get the dichotomy there, right? You're trying to appeal to women, suburban women. She's got like the suburban housewife, much, much younger. I mean, can you Google how young she is? Very, very young, cute. I get it. The juxtaposition next 42. To Biden, she's what?
Very, very young, 42.
Oh, I thought you said 14. I was like, no. Yes, very young, very, very 42. Young. But anyway, I get it. Like lively, bubbly, cute smile, dimples, all the whole thing. It was like she was delivering, she was doing a tryout for a Lifetime movie. Yeah. It was like highs and lows and like, oh, like if I was trying to just read a script of acting, oh, it was so bad. It was so cringy. Mm. And even Republicans were like, well, that wasn't her best performance.
In the kitchen.
And it's just like, woman in the kitchen, you know? It was so bad on so many levels.
Why aren't
such a disconnect.
The Republican Party's advisors.
I mean, honestly, they need help.
Every time.
It was a train wreck. So anyway, Democrats got to, celebrate, Biden being so lively and aggressive and all of this. And then Katie Britt came on and delivered a performance that was even too much for a Lifetime movie. So could have done better, but at least Marco Rubio's off the hook. For his
for his drinking,
water episode.
I miss him, actually.
I know, right? Oh, so bad. Okay, we'll get to your questions and comments and our sanity check, which is very serious today. I don't know if you guys heard what's happening right now in the Issaquah School District. There was some sort of altercation this morning we'll talk about. But gosh, these videos that are circulating online of this fight between students in Missouri that landed a girl in critical condition is just horrifying, but it all speaks to a broader problem that we're having in our schools right now. First, I've been encouraging you guys, given the state of the economy, global unrest, lying headlines about the economy, Biden trying to paint everything as all hunky-dory when our economy is a house of cards. I've been encouraging you guys, especially if you're close to retirement or in retirement, managing your risk this year is critical. Zach Abraham and his team at Bulwark Capital, this is what they specialize in, is managing risk. They don't get distracted by the, you know, NVIDIA and all these, you know, crazy stocks that are being sold. They don't get distracted by that because they're laser focused and they've got a whole team that is looking at all of the factors that are telling them which way the economy is heading. And so I suggest, if you haven't done so already, just scheduling a free Know Your Risk review with Zach and his team at Bulwark Capital. It's a great way just to see if your retirement portfolio is overexposed to risk. You've worked very hard for your retirement. Make sure that you are not leaving it susceptible to this crazy market that we're in. So schedule your free risk review now at knowyourriskradio.com. That's knowyourriskradio.com. Investment advisory services offered through Trek Financial, LLC, an SEC-registered investment advisor. Investments involve risk and are not guaranteed. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. I feel like I want to read that in my best Katie Britt voice. Hold on. I need some water. Investment advisory services are offered through Trek Financial, LLC, an SEC-registered investment advisor. Investments involve risk and are not guaranteed. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. How'd I do?
Well.
I mean, don't get me wrong. Biden's speech was still worse because that was absolutely unhinged and divisive. Had Trump ever given a speech that divisive, the media would never have let it go.
Oh, man, yeah.
Just pitting Americans against one another. Ridiculous.
They were all like, oh, you did so great. So much energy.
I also could be energized if you gave me some uppers. Maybe that's what I needed for the show today. All right, let's get to our daily subscriber show poll. I was just curious because it is the presidential primary in Washington State tomorrow. So you need to make sure that if you are participating, that you get those ballots in. And yes, I'm sorry, you do have to check a party affiliation on the outside. There is no way around it if you want to participate and you want your vote to count. Let's see. So I asked you guys, tomorrow is Washington's presidential primary. Will you be voting? A lot of you are saying no, about 40% right now saying no. Let me see. Jill says, in this instance, is our vote really needed? We all know who the presidential candidates are. I feel that having to declare a party on the outside of the envelope, no less, is intended to instantly give those in Olympia the names of Republican and Democratic voters. To what end? Meanwhile, independence is completely ignored. Kathleen says, I voted as soon as the ballot came in the mail. I was thrilled to vote for Nikki Haley, per a chance to dream. E says, I don't and will never belong to any political party, and unless they allow independent declaration and vote, it's not happening. I do vote on everything else. Let me see here. Jackie says, I am not a Republican or a Democrat, but I do think it's a shame that they don't add a checkbox for independent. I agree. Cheryl says, what are they using the party information for? Well, that's a good question. Practically speaking, it is because you're voting in a political process. So you're supposed, this is about the parties, which are political entities, choosing their nominee. So you're saying either I want to participate in the choice for nominee on the Democratic side or the Republican side. That's why for only the presidential primary, you do have to check a box. I get that. I don't like that the box is on the outside, but you're choosing a party nominee. I do think you should have to say, here's the party I'm going to choose a nominee for, right? What they're using it, so that's what they're using it for. But also, if you check Democrat or Republican because you want to participate in that side of the process, you're going to get a bunch of junk mail. I mean, I just got it. I donated to Dave Riker's campaign. So I'm already on their little list now.
Oh, yeah.
And now I'm getting, like, letters from the Republican Congressional Caucus, like, help us flip these seats. And I'm like, Brandy, It's worth it, but just throw it away. Ignore it. So yeah, you're going to get a bunch of junk mail, basically. Let me see here. Harold says, wrong tense. I already did. I held my nose and cast my ballot. Good for you. I will not be participating. That's the decision that I made. I don't want to check a party affiliation. I agree. I wish independent was a choice, and then you could choose from the list who you wanted to vote for. So while I am a diehard voter and I have an exceptional voting history, I will not be participating in the presidential primary. Okay, questions and comments. Let's see here.
For the record, I will.
Oh, sorry, Nicole. Hey, Nicole, will you be participating in the presidential primary? Yeah. Who'd you vote for?
Reichert. I know, I'm kidding. Trump. I'm all Trump. I've said it. I don't care. I mean, I wouldn't pick him if I had a choice of other, candidates. But yeah, I'll pick him if that's what I got.
Yeah.
Hey. I mean, Haley's not going to make it. Sorry. And
yeah, her name's on there, but
there are other people that I would have voted for. Rubio. I would have picked Rubio if he was on there.
Yeah.
I think he was a good candidate.
He was fine.
He was great. And
he's handsome.
We just allowed the media to destroy him. That's why he's gone. We just allowed him to be destroyed.
They'll destroy any Republican. And that's the other thing.
I know.
That's my other thing on Trump is Trump is an exceptionally different person. And I understand to a certain extent the initial pile on from the media. Mm-hmm. And then it got so ridiculous. And then I said the same thing about DeSantis is I would have preferred DeSantis, but they would have treated DeSantis just like Trump.
Absolutely.
They would have just taken that anger and rage. Yeah. And they would have moved it over to DeSantis. So he wouldn't have been free from that baggage anyway.
They did. And it was just divided a bit. But I really think that as long as we keep allowing the media to do this to the candidates, the only ones that will get through are the Trumps of the world. The ones that are obnoxious and deal with this and just brush it off.
Not just the media, though. The Republican Party and Trump supporters were vicious to Nikki Haley. I mean, unhinged vicious.
Right. So I'm saying that as long as we allow the candidates to be attacked the way that they're attacked, those are the only people, the people that are kind of not great with words and the people that can brush off the attacks that are thrown at them constantly. So I think that's what needs to change is the media's perspective on the whole situation. Start being unbiased.
Yeah, that's not going to happen.
That's
never going to happen. Mm-hmm. Matt Gilbert with $5 Super Chat. Just another manic Monday. Denise, $20 Super Chat. Nicole and Brandy, Vacation Fund. Country Guy. So the appointed sheriff can overrule the elected city council, and the appointed sheriff is now the arbitrator of constitutionality. And that's the issue, too, is continue to carry out the law. And then if there's some ruling that it's unconstitutional, then stop doing it at that point in time. It's just wild. And yeah, I mean, it's not about the sheriff. The sheriff is serving at the pleasure of politicians. So the sheriff is going to do what politicians want her to do. And that's unfortunate because Patty Cool Tyndall actually had a pretty good reputation heading into that job. I mean, even among a rank and file for the most part. I mean, she didn't have kind of the street level experience that you would want sometimes out of a sheriff. And I think there's been complaints about that, at Seattle PD as well. But there were no knocks on her character that I was aware of before she got appointed to that position. TZ Burton, a court can mandate anything they want. If they can't back it up with force, it's not a mandate. I'm not sure what that's in reference to. It could be a couple of our stories today.
It was the Burian.
Gloria Mellon says, one of my good friends is closing his gun store in Bremerton because of all this. And I don't blame him. It's you're trying to run a business. And because the government doesn't like the business you're in, even though it's a completely legal business, they're going to make it so expensive that you can't do business anymore. That's wild. Ray Stewart says, Second Amendment is the only constitutional right that is overly regulated. Bring that up, Randy. And I agree with you. And so that is my issue. I'm not per se a gun person, but I am someone who firmly supports the Constitution. So I don't believe in just being okay with the government chipping away at and over-regulating one constitutional amendment, even though I'm not uber passionate about it, because there are other constitutional amendments that I am very passionate about. So you have to fight for all of them, or you're fighting for none of them. Todd Welch on the costly salmon adventure. The Washington legislature has wasted so much time on the culvert issue that the price continues to rise due to inaction. Kathy McDonald, there sure seems to be a lot of power outages lately. Two in my area in the last 2 days alone. Oh, talking about our power outage here. Yeah, we weren't here when it happened, but we kind of know when there's a power outage because we've got these lights on all over the studio.
Oh, and plus it took me 20 minutes just to get the computer on this morning.
Yeah, we had trouble getting our computer on. The lights, they when they turn off and turn back on, they're all white. Mm-hmm. And so we know that something has happened. So anyway.
It's been rough lately.
It's been a real adventure.
It makes you really excited for going all electric, right?
Yeah. That'll go great.
When there's even more stress on the grid.
Perfect.
Great.
Definitely won't have more power outages then. Let me see here. On what's happening in Denver, Dean Wade says, Washington forced landlords to house non-paying tenants. This is nothing new. And that is kind of true. you know, we're complaining about, oh, you might have to, or the, it's an encouragement at this point for landlords to give vacant units to immigrants who are coming in. But in Washington State, I mean, you have U.S. citizens who are taking units and then not paying, and they'll be there for years on end. I mean, how many stories have we done on that? So landlords are just screwed over. It's like, God forbid that you did well or you worked hard and you bought a unit so you could rent it out and have some sort of passive income, and the government just screws you over left and right. They really believe that that's your property, is their property to do what they want with. Yeah.
Wild.
Okay, on Reichert and Ferguson, Julie said Reichert should just say, I won't vote for Biden. Yeah?
I mean, why does he have to? He can say the same thing that you're saying. I'll make that decision when the day comes, or why
I think
is
that's
it
kind of what
business?
He said, though. And but it just gives an opening for Bob to use it against
him.
When you haven't given an answer, Bob's like, well, that's an answer. And he has nothing else. And unfortunately, in this state, the TDS type 1 is very real, and people will look at that and be like, oh, I can't have a Trump supporter in the governor's office. It's just an adventure. On the State of the Union, Chrisman says, Brandy, usually I agree, but I think her rebuttal was on target. Presentation could have been better, but what she said was on target. Yeah, but what? Yeah, the words are only half the battle.
I've lost.
The effectiveness of the delivery is huge. Yeah, I agree. I think what she said was fine. It was how she said it. And it makes me wonder, did you not practice in front of other people? Did you not? You're giving the rebuttal to the State of the Union. Did the Republican Party not have you do a run-through where they could watch it and offer you some feedback?
Or she could watch herself. I think she could watch herself and say, ooh, and that doesn't come across,
well, and
right?
If they did and they thought it was fine, that's an even bigger problem. Oh. So it's just, and you do have so many wonderful orators on the Republican side who I think could have done a much, much better job. People were saying Vivek. No, I don't think Vivek is the right person. Again, you're trying, I get the choice of the person and the message, 100%. But I think there are other, you know, young women on the Republican side who are proven orators who could have delivered that message. It wasn't just in an effective way, but in a relatable way.
Yep.
You know, sitting there in that pristine kitchen, which, like, man, you want to look at my kitchen
it
right now,
like,
you know,
1950s kitchen.
It was just strange.
I do not buy
and
that that's
it,
her
it's
kitchen.
Not relatable. And you were going for relatable and it just really fell flat. Mm-hmm. All right. Before we get to our closing sanity check, I do just want to, we're following this right now. We don't really know. There's a lot of conflicting information. I think that's fair to say, Nicole, right?
Because
you've been in touch with the Issaquah School District.
The latest is no arrest. The kids went home with parents. I haven't heard of any major injuries, and the aid car left with no one in it.
Yeah, so it says this morning there was an alert sent out to Issaquah High School families. This morning an altercation occurred between students in our commons area. Police responded to assist. Out of abundance of caution and to help with our investigation, we placed the school in lockdown. The lockdown has been lifted. We're proceeding to third period with our regular schedule. We understand that some students ask parents and guardians to pick them up. If your student asks this of you, please connect with our attendance office. So that's kind of crazy, because then it's like, if you need support, reach out to our counseling team. So I'm like, oh my God, how bad was this? If kids are like, I want my parents to pick me up. Now, our friend Jonathan Cho has been pushing some information out there. We just haven't been able to verify with the school.
Well,
but
I've been told it's wrong. But
oh, the school did tell you it's wrong. Okay, so then we won't share
inaccurate.
It. But it sounded like the fight was pretty bad. Mm-hmm. And obviously it was bad enough to go on lockdown, to have a police response, to have an aid car come to the scene, and to have some parents come to the school and pick their kids up. And this just came up today, and it's sort of in line with what we wanted to talk about in our closing sanity check. Go ahead and I'll make the noise. Closing sanity check. So I have seen, and this is hard on social media, man. I almost, you know, I'm for free speech, but there's some things that I just don't want to see on social media. I just don't want to see it come across my timeline. And some of these vicious fights that have been happening in schools or outside of schools are one of those things where it's like kids beating kids senseless, kids beating kids near death. And I know it's happening, and it's one of those things where I really fight between, like, maybe people should see it so they can wake up to what's going on, but just the brutal nature of it. And if you have X, you probably have seen the video of this fight in Missouri. This is from the New York Post. Teen girl has head repeatedly bashed into concrete in gruesome caught on camera brawl. The last update on this teenager is that she's in critical condition. I'm not going to play the video, obviously, but you saw It was, and I'm just going to say it because it's relevant to part of what I want to discuss. It was a bunch of black students surrounding this one white girl. No information on what started the fight or whatever. And so you've got a black girl and a white girl. The black girl punches her to the ground, grabs her head, slams it against the concrete several times. And then you see this white girl who's in clear, like some sort of convulsions or seizure or something like that, because she just had her head repeatedly bashed into the concrete and she could die. And there was one arrest that happened as a result of this. But we're seeing this more and more frequently. And one of the reasons I mentioned the races involved is if the situation had been reversed, this would lead every newscast in the country. I mean, if it had been a bunch of white kids surrounding one black student and a black student whose head was repeatedly bashed into the concrete, it would be the lead story on every national newscast, and it would immediately be about race, and it would immediately be a racial issue. And I hate making things about race for that reason, is like, I don't want it when it's on one side, unless race has something to do with it, right? Now, did race have something to do with this? And I don't know what led up to this fight. We don't have that context, but it's frustrating to me that this video seems to have, and it was covered in the local news, but it seems to be a lot of conservatives sharing it, where I think that something this vicious, again, had the roles been reversed, I think it would have been an instant mainstream lead story across all the networks. But there's something else happening here, I think, and that is, you know, ideology that has done this, ideology that has taught our kids that there aren't consequences for their behavior, ideology in our schools that have taught our kids that there's no standard for learning. You know, if you show up, we can't fail a kid that shows up, at least. You know, there's no standards for performance in schools, academic. There is this concern that, oh gosh, punishment is disproportionately impacting kids of one skin color or the other. So let's just reduce the kind of punishments that kids get from school when they misbehave, when they act out. And so all along the line, there's all these missed opportunities to hold kids accountable for their behavior, whether it's underperformance academically, whether it's behavior or how they're treating other kids in school, bullying, et cetera. All of that driven by ideology and the desire that, oh, we've got to take it easy on these kids, that driven by an ideology around identitarianism. And so they see all of this ignored their whole lives in the school setting. I can get away with this. I can get away with not doing this. I can get away with doing this. And then it gets to the point where this lesson has been instilled in them for so long that they do something like this that has consequences so severe that it can't be ignored, so severe that they will face repercussions for it under the law. And by that point, it's too late. So now you have a young woman who could die, and you have another young woman who is going to go to prison, especially if the person whose head she bashed against the concrete dies. And school officials and this left ideology is to blame for that. I really believe that. We have to teach kids at every juncture that there are expectations of them in a school setting. There are academic expectations, there are behavioral expectations, and more importantly, there are consequences. Whether you fail a class because you didn't live up to academic expectations, whether you're removed from school, whether you're suspended because you didn't live up to behavioral expectations. Because if we're not teaching them the small lessons, they're going to learn their lesson the really difficult way and in a permanent way that cannot be undone. One more note, we will not have a live show tomorrow. We will be at the memorial for Washington State Patrol Trooper Christopher Gadd at Angel of the Winds. And so if you are going, we will likely see you there. Please say hello. And if you can, show up to pay your respects for Trooper Gadd. And I think just a law enforcement community that needs to know that the vast majority of us support the work that they're doing. We know it's difficult. We know it's dangerous. We know there are a lot of things in this state working against them, but we're going to be there to support them and to mourn with them. So we will be there tomorrow, no show, but we will see you back on the live show on Wednesday at noon. And that has been today's episode of Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you so much for your commitment to giving Common Sense a comeback. If you have not signed up to support our show already, you can do so for just $5 a month at undividedpod.com. That's undividedpod.com.